Are you team old Victorian drama book Fingersmith or team Korean Japanese movie Handmaiden? It's Pride Month special episode of Seeing Red.
Woo!
Woo! Welcome back to Seeing Red, episode 11.
Nice.
Happy Pride Month, Kelly.
Thank you. It's my month. Thank you.
It's your month, not my month. It's
no,
your month.
No, your month is next month.
That's true. That's why I let you pick the book.
Thank you. Also, I would have liked to have heard your gay book suggestions.
I don't have any.
That's fantastic also.
Sorry. Hey, you're opening up my world.
Yeah, like an oyster girl. Which is a reference to Tipping the Velvet. We don't have to go down that path. It's equally gay. Don't worry.
On today's episode, we're going to be talking about the book Fingersmith and the movie The Handmaiden.
Finger to hand, baby.
That's right. Which team are you? Finger or hand?
I'm team Fist Factory.
Just a pre-warning to our listeners. This is going to be a wild episode. Very much rated
explicit,
R.
Explicit, if you will.
Yes.
I will say we don't have fun.
Before we get into book news, movie news, you know, you mentioned that you're opening up my world to the LGBTQ book world that is out there. And what a start. What a start. I was kind of hesitant going in. You did not fail, Kelly. You did not fail.
Thank you. I felt like this was... It's a good introduction. You know what I mean? Like, there's a groundwork we've laid out with, I would say, things like Gone Girl and all these other novels. It's a mix of, like, literature and sensationalized historical fiction. I like to refer to it as clit-erature. So for all of you Charles Dickens fans, leave the dick at home. We've got Sarah Waters, hot and bothered, ready to come in hot. And The Handmaiden, honestly, is way more pornographic than the novel even tries to attempt to be. So, I mean, we got a lot to work here.
Yeah, it's going to be a great episode. I was not bored. Let me put it that way.
I'm glad to hear that. Because, like, I was a little nervous when you said you were listening to the audio.
Yeah.
The Audible book. The audiobook?
Yeah.
Only because, like, I feel like there's a way to the book itself, like, lulls you into thinking it's a very typical storyline and very, like, you know, Victorian drama, secret relationship kind of vibe going on. And then it turns into something completely different. And I think, like, hearing that narration in a very Shakespearean-esque British accent may kind of lull you further into boredom. But I'm glad at least that you got, like, some twists and turns out of the whole thing.
Yeah. No, it was great. So before we jump in, what's going on? Book world? Any book news? Anything going on?
Yeah.
Since last we talked?
Cormac McCarthy, author extraordinaire, has passed on to a country for old men, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, he's there looking at all the pretty horses. I'm personally not a fan of his body of work. I haven't read enough, so I guess I can't really talk too much, but I have read Blood Meridian, which has left a Caesarean scar on my heart. Like, I'm sorry, that book fucking rotted my brain. But he is an excellent author. I do have to admit to that. And I do want to read, and I actually really want to do an episode possibly.
I was going to say, we should do No Country for Old Men.
That was my choice too. I think I actually really enjoyed that movie. It's a Coen Brothers movie. I never read the novel, and I'm really curious to see how that was done. So if there was a book that I had to read, I know All the Pretty Horses also is, like, pretty hailed. And I think it's technically a trilogy. I'd be willing to pick it up. But I mean, if anyone hasn't read Blood Meridian, if you took toxic masculinity and the most flowery prose known to mankind, and you combined those two things, what you would get are babies in trees, puppies in rivers, and a dancing bear that you get shot at the end. And I was just like, you know what? When that dancing bear went, so did I. Like, I couldn't take that much more. So it's something for somebody. I mean, Cormac really did lay out a great... He's an excellent author. I do have to admit to that. The man had his ability to compose words, and his prose is really something to commend. But yet again, if you're not a Southern Gothic fan, this might be a little rough for you. But at the same time, RIP. I mean, even Stephen King tweeted out his, you know, thoughts and prayers to the family.
Respect the game.
Yeah, you got to respect the game, brother, you know? So I really feel it. And honestly, I do encourage people to read him. If it's not for you, join my camp. And yet again, I mean, the man squeezed out, I think it was called The Passenger, which was his most recent novel. I think it was part of a 2-book series. I could be wrong with that. But I mean, he squeezed one last drop out of his body before he desiccated and dried up and blew off into the wind.
One way to put
it. As a sage bush, as with like doo 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 doo. Peace. So R.I.P. Yeah, R.I.P. Otherwise, I mean, book news, that was pretty much the biggest one I could really think of. I made a really good book haul in June, but that's really my book news, not the worldly book news.
Well, you've talked about it in the past, I don't know, 3-4 episodes, but you finally finished
The Rise of Endymion.
Third Hyperion.
Not a coincidence that Cormac McCarthy died as soon as that happened. He was like, I'm taking it with me. Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts on it. If anyone has read the Hyperion Cantos, particularly the Endymion and the Rise of Endymion part of that, I have a lot of feelings I need to unburden my soul with. So please reach out to me and talk to me. Is there a Reddit group I need to be part of? A therapy discussion circle? It's not bad. It just wasn't great. And I hate to say it, but it's kind of like, and I'll put this in terms that you may understand, Jimmy.
Oh,
it's
thank
like
you for
Star-
dumping it down
it's
for
like
me.
Star Wars. And like, I had like, you know, Return of the Jedi and all these great things. And I was so engaged. And there was like, you know, some misses in the Fall of Hyperion. But I think, like, ultimately that story was just so satisfying and everything was so excellent and really did challenge you that Endymion was kind of like the prequels.
Okay.
Or maybe even furthermore, the last three ones with Rhea.
Yeah.
And honestly, I also really don't know if Dan Simmons knows how to write female characters. And that's fine if you keep them minimal enough. But yeah, kind of not a bummer, but like not a highlight. So I get it. Yay me.
I'm happy where I left off with my Hyperion.
Yeah. It's like my
saga.
Dexter kind of comment. Like, you know, sometimes it's good to leave it where it should have been left.
It ended well for me. So
yeah,
I'm satisfied. I don't need to keep going.
I mean, I'm open to read more Dan Simmons. I just...
Yeah.
And Damien, you could leave it.
Yep.
Yeah. So I movie news. Let's trailblaze past my failures.
Yeah, I had a great movie month. 3 recommendations. I saw the new movie Air, the Air Jordan movie that's on Amazon Prime with Ben Affleck, Matt Damon.
The entirety of Boston.
Yep.
Mark Wahlberg was making burgers in the background.
He missed the cut, I guess. I don't know. But very good. And it's funny because for a movie about a shoe, about Michael Jordan isn't...
For a movie about a shoe.
Shoe, about a basketball player. Michael Jordan isn't in it at all. So it's very interesting. Viola Davis plays
Michael Jordan's mom. Oh.
And I guess they went to Michael Jordan and asked who should play his mom, and he picked Viola Davis.
I mean, so, solid choice.
Yeah, if you're going to pick someone to play your mom.
Yeah.
Great choice. I saw the Super Mario Brothers.
As did I. Quality.
Fantastic.
Quality.
Thank God.
Because, I know. I was worried.
The first Super Mario Brothers movie.
Now, I didn't say that. I listen.
There's Team That Movie, and then there's Anti That Movie.
That which shall not be named. Listen, the live action walked so animated Mario could run. And honestly, I liked it. And I was like, I was so happy to have seen it in theaters and to see who was watching it in theaters. I think you have to understand who that movie was for to really appreciate it even more. Because when you realize it's a kid movie and it's just a movie for dads and children to bond and get their Easter eggs and enjoy like a little bit of fun time. It's so cute and adorable.
Yeah.
And I love the nihilism and existential angst that Lulumi or whatever the character's name was.
Yeah. The adult humor
Lumally.
Mixed in with the kid. Yeah.
Oh.
The adult humor mixed in with the kid humor was perfectly balanced.
Loved.
The cast was great. Mm. Everybody was nervous about Chris Pratt playing Mario. And, you know, I think everyone did a fantastic job.
And I think so too.
Like you said, it laid enough Easter eggs for the adults that grew up with Mario, but also enough of a kid's movie to enjoy it with your kids at the same time. So anybody could enjoy it.
It was really cute. We were like, Kate and I were both like, look, it's Donkey Kong. And like how they incorporated the story is like, as soon as we saw the Mario Karts, we ascended into the higher echelon. But yeah, it was a really fun movie. So I'm glad you saw it and liked it too.
Yeah. I finally got out to the movies. So that was good.
Left the kid at home. You can grow up before you come see this.
I'm trying to think of the appropriate age to bring James to his first movie experience. So more to come on that. I will definitely let you know when that happens.
Yeah, we'll do a countdown.
And what his first movie is.
Mine That'll be important. Little Mermaid. What was yours?
Oh, God, I don't even know.
Ugh. Drop
I'd have to think about that.
The ball.
I'd have to think about that.
Yeah,
don't know.
Dig deep. Go into our hypnosis.
I feel like when I was a kid, we didn't really go to the movies that much until I was like in high school. It was like a high school thing to do. So I don't remember.
I want you to tell me what it is.
Well, we'll have to pause that and I will text my parents and then get back to you.
Accusingly, by the way. Just be like, by the way, this memory didn't last, so you really
I don't remember what happened
with this. My movie experience with The Little Mermaid was amazing, but I was very afraid of Ursula. And my mom and my grandmother had taken me to see it. And my mom thought the best thing to do was to tell me that Ursula looked like my grandma, which she did. And then I was terrified of my grandma for like 3 months.
Kind of so backfired.
That was kind of like a family divide for a couple months, but we all worked it out. And now like Ursula is just that much more endeared to me, you know?
Yeah, I mean, and now you have that connection forever.
Yeah.
See, that's what you need for that memory is some sort of like connection.
Trauma. Yes. Understood.
I did see the Power Rangers in the drive-in. That was my first drive-in experience. So I remember that.
Oh, like the old school, like first Power Ranger
movie? The first movie. Yeah.
Can I be honest? I've never been to a drive-in movie theater.
Oh, we should go.
I know.
There's one right behind my house.
Fun fact. Did you build it?
It's in my backyard.
It's my backyard. Don't worry about it. It kind of is your backyard.
Well, that's true. And then, last but not least, third movie of the week was Fast 10.
I'm going to Fast and Furious. Just barf away. Enjoy.
The thing is I've seen 9 of them. You can't just not see 10. You have to keep it going until they're done, which they're never going to be done.
No.
I've heard, I don't know, this is part one of... I don't know how many parts to Fast 10. So I've heard it's 2. I've heard
Endless
it's a trilogy.
Parts.
I've heard it's a trilogy as the final part. So I don't know.
What is even the story anymore? I just think it's so funny that it started off as like a vice operation to like crack down on like drag racing, I'm assuming. I forget because it happened in like 98 or whatever. And now we're still going. And all it does is it's just sort of like... I think Hollywood has given steroids to people and they're just like cultivating their Fast and Furious cast every year. They're like, who's ripe for the picking?
Yeah, and they keep adding people and taking people away and then adding people and taking people away. And
I know.
You never know who's going to be on the next one.
Well, I know Paul Walker won't be.
Click it or ticket. Oof.
Brie Larson's in it though, right?
Brie Larson is in it.
I love her.
Yeah. I know, but the problem with Brie Larson is she's such a good actor. And it's like, why are you doing
this?
Why are you doing these movies? You don't need to do these movies. Why you don't need to be in Marvel and Fast and Furious.
Like she has a mortgage too, okay? Let Brie Larson.
Vin Diesel is in Marvel and in Fast and Furious. So are you saying Brie Larson is on the same level as Vin Diesel?
Isn't he though? Who plays Groot?
Vin Diesel.
Yeah, so he's in Marvel.
That's what I'm saying. He's in Marvel and in Fast and Furious, and so is Brie Larson.
Oh, true.
Same character, same actor level.
Wow. This is too much for my blood. All right. Anyway.
I will say I liked it better for my Fast and Furious fans out there, because I know there are some out there.
Clearly.
Yeah, they wouldn't keep making these if it wasn't a thing. But I recommend this one over 9. Highly recommend. 9 was a bit of a stretch. They've gone back to their roots a little bit in 10, I will say. Jason Momoa plays the villain, and he does a pretty good job. At first, it's like a little cringy, and then you just lean in, like you always do in these, like at the beginning. First half hour, you're like, oh, this could be so cringy. And then once you accept and lean in and take it for what it is, it's amazing.
I love it. Just they live your truth.
The perfect balance of cars and Coronas. You can't go wrong. Kelly, you signed up for this podcast with me.
So gay literature.
Happy Pride Month.
Happy Pride Month. Cars. Woo! Going back to the Transformers real fast. Anyway, glad you enjoyed it. I'm also glad that it redeemed itself after 9. I can only imagine what happened in 9. I think I stopped. I think it was 7 when they drove the car into the helicopter and the rock broke out of the cast.
Yeah, that was 7. 9, they went into space. So
see, they sometimes I feel like Fast and Furious is like the brave little toaster. And I would like to make a correlation between that because I feel like the storylines are just being reused at this point in time.
Well, that's definitely true.
Because I remember when the Brave Little Toaster went to space, and I guarantee you, if I watched Fast and Furious 9, I'd be like, I've seen this movie before. And that heated blanket was a fucking star.
There's a formula.
There is.
So that's my movie news. That's all I got on the movie updates. That's what I've seen. And The Handmaiden, obviously.
Oh, boy. Oh,
what a treat.
Let me tell you something. Of all the movies we could have watched together for this podcast, I am nothing but thrilled that the first movie we decided to do was this one.
We need to do, going forward, and I wish we did this for this one, is record us watching a movie together and then post it to Patreon so our Patreon listeners can watch and listen at the same time.
This is true. Because let me tell you.
This would have been a good one.
It was a very good one. There was a lot of jaws on the floor.
A lot of, whoa! Long woes.
There was like the deep woos. Like not like the woo girl like from Tiara. Like woo.
No.
It was like a deep sacral region woo of like
It's burned fear. In my eyeballs forever.
And it was funny because, like, I had seen the movie, I think maybe twice now, but, I mean, not
the perfect amount of times.
And I knew the ending, I was like, that's kind of insane, like, a little bit much. And I was like, I feel like the sex scene goes on a little bit long, too. And then watching it with you guys, I was like, I made a choice. Today, I made a choice. It was a pretty hard one. Yeah, I truly did.
Probably. It was a good choice, though.
Yeah.
It was a fun night, for sure. Fun night to be had by all.
I learned a lot. Yes, thank you for our culture and our people. You could go to Pride confidently now and just be like, nah.
I understand.
Yeah, I get it. I know where those pieces go. Yeah. Anyway, where would you like to begin?
Let's start with the book, Fingersmith.
Ooh, all right. Well, I thought I would regale us at least with what the book cover actually says the book is about.
Go for it.
And then I will also spoil what actually happens in it.
Yeah, a lot of spoilers. Oh, pre-warning.
Big spoilers. So, by the way, if you haven't read or watched this movie, I would definitely recommend reading the book.
Me too.
Watching the movie. And
compare them.
And compare them. I think book first, movie second. It'll work better that way. And let me tell you, you will enjoy the ride because...
Can I just do a quick pause?
Yes.
If you haven't read this book or watched this movie, stop this episode right now and start because it is a ride. Both of them. And come back to this episode.
Unpredictable. And it will ruin it because I did watch the movie first. I watched the BBC trilogy because there's another adaptation we haven't talked about, which is the BBC version.
No, I know that one.
Yeah.
Which I didn't want to watch because it looked too close to the book and I wanted something.
It's actually pretty good.
Good.
Clearly. So if you want, if you're just like, wow, I have an itch that only a fingersmith can scratch. Jump on the BBC, America, and take it all in. It also has Tipping the Velvet, which I will continue to talk about this entire podcast. Anyway, please watch it. So I watched the movie first, and honestly, I do wish I read the book because I think
so. You watched The Handmaiden first.
I watched the Fingersmith adaptation on BBC first.
Got it.
And then I read the book, and then I watched The Handmaiden. And honestly, I forget at this point in juncture in time if I had actually, if I was aware that The Handmaiden was based on Fingersmith. I think I started watching it and I was like, wait a second. Is that Sookie? Sookie and Maud? Because, like, in the book, it does reference that Sue is actually referred to as Sookie sometimes.
Oh, right. Yes.
And they actually carry that on into The Handmaiden. So anyway,
I'm
pretty positive I didn't know. And then when I found out it was based on the Fingersmith movie or book, I was like, my brains were on the back end of my chair. What a visual. So yes, anyway, so let me tell you what the book is about. We'll get into it further before we keep dancing around, but please read the book first, because let me tell you, the reveals are worth it, and I think you need the pacing of the book to get to the actual points of it. Anywho, picture this. London, 1862. Sue Trinder, orphaned at birth, grows up among petty thieves, fingersmiths, under the rough but loving care of Miss Suxby and her quote-unquote family. One day, gentleman, an elegant con man, arrives with a proposition for Sue. If she works as a maid to Maud Lilly, a gentlewoman, and aids gentleman in her seduction, they will all share in Maud's vast inheritance. With dreams of repaying her adopted family, Sue agrees to the plan. Once in, however, Sue begins to pity Maud and care for her in unexpected ways. But nothing is as it seems in this Dickensian? Novel of thrills and reveals.
Girl! Lots of thrills, lots of reveals.
The reveals, they start and then they don't stop coming. So about three quarters through this book, you follow Sue along this path of trying to figure out how to be a handmaiden to Maud Lilly, right?
And the book's pretty much broken into three parts.
Yes, and it literally says that it's part one, part two, part three. It doesn't give you the POVs per chapter. Chapter?
Yes, per chapter.
Chapter. It doesn't give you the POVs. You have to kind of like read a little bit before you get into who you're actually reading of. But for the most part, you do follow Sue, which I think is the best POV to start with. And Sue is of poverty. She works in a thieves' den of people that just basically scam for a living. And is approached by a gentleman who is like kind of like a perhaps befallen upon a wealthy man who like is kind of a dick and like just a piece of shit that likes to go around and scam people and do all this shit. Brings his money back and his like plots to like make more money for other people. Loves to gamble. Possibly gay. We don't know.
I think so, but we'll talk more about that.
I'm team gay on that. So anyway, so he comes and approaches them and says, hey, I need Sue, by the way. And Sue has been very, like, kept close to the breast of Miss Suxby, who is the mother, who's a mother figure. It's pretty well known that Sue doesn't know her parents. She knows that her mother was a thief and a murderess and was hung outside in eye view of the window that she grows up in. And for the most part, thinks she's also a piece of shit, because a big narrative part of this novel is nature and nurture, and this idea that was especially very antiquated now is that the sins of the father reflect on the child. So she thinks, my mom's a murderess, I'm a murderess, I'm equally as piece of shitty as everybody else, I'm just going to live out my fate because this is what's been laid out for me. So when gentleman comes and says, hey Sue, you've been coddled by Miss Suxby and her baby farm, which is a job I would never take on, but would you like to come and scam this very rich inherited heiress that lives in this crumbling mansion in the countryside of England? Sue says, sure, goes, tries her best to like kind of like convince girl Maud that she's in love with gentleman so gentleman can like get married to her and put her into a madhouse as soon as he gets the inheritance. Well, part two hits.
Yeah.
And the twist begins. The whole time Sue thinks that she's pulling one up on Maud and kind of falls in love with Maud. Turns out Maud knew the whole time. And Maud was
part of this plan with gentlemen.
Exactly. Maude had made the plan with Gentleman to fool Sue into thinking that she was going to be scamming her. And Maude would then put her in the madhouse as herself, quote unquote, Maude Lily,
yes,
convincing her that she had gone mad, and then run off with Gentleman to cash in on her inheritance.
Are you still following this?
Are you still following? So Girl A thought she was fooling Girl B. Girl B fooled Girl A. And Sue, Girl A, is now in the madhouse.
Yes.
Turns out the twist Cut continues two. To come.
Cut two.
So
now we're in Maude's world.
Maude thinks her mom was clinically insane and she was born in a madhouse. So revisiting her old haunts, if you will. So Maude goes back to live with her uncle, who's a creepy old pervert that makes her read pornography to a group of men.
Just like
since
books.
The age
porn
of
books.
13. Porn books. Like, the whole time you think Maude is like this erudite, like, educated woman, that her uncle is also a nerd, that just they just sit inside the library all day copying things to create a gigantic dictionary. Well, the dick is in dictionary because it's just a compendium of pornography, because the old uncle is a creepy, creepy asshole that collects porn and is trying to make an index of it of sorts.
Yeah.
And has created a space in his home to invite other creepy gentlemen over to listen to Maude read from these books. So,
and what's funny about this whole part, real quick, too, is when Sue goes to live with Maude and is her handmaiden, she's under the assumption that Maude is this very prude
sheltered girl,
doesn't know anything about the world. So she's like, you don't know what kissing is? And she's like, in the back of her head, she's like, I know more than that.
Do I? Like, Maude is very educated, but it's, and we'll get to this too, because like, what's interesting is the performance of it. But Maude has acted as like, and there is things that are sheltered about Maude. Maude doesn't know about the world outside of her uncle's house. She knows about whipping page boys into erotic bliss, but she knows nothing further about like how to exchange cash for, I don't know, paper goods. So Maude has come off as very innocent, is innocent in certain ways, but is very spoiled because like she is now the porn queen of southeastern London. So next twist comes is basically Maude gets scammed by Gentleman in not so much a scam, but Gentleman brings her
back to London.
Back to London to Mrs. Suxby's house, which is in the shittiest of shit places of London. And it's just a bunch of people putting molasses in their hair to curl it and raising babies as a means to like pay for rent. Maude is none too thrilled. She thinks she's going to like, you know, somewhere else, and then she'll leave Gentleman, cash in her check, and give Gentleman half of hers. As things go on, she tries to escape, goes and tries to work for the porn guy that she has met at her uncle's house. This is getting way too much. Anyway, turns out Maude is Mrs. Suxby's actual daughter. And Sue is the rich woman's daughter. And what happens at birth is that Sue's mother, the wealthy woman who went into the madhouse, escaped the uncle and the father because they were probably both creepy weirdos, hid out in the shittiest part of London, went to Mrs. Suxby and was like, I'm pregnant, can you fix this? And she was like, sure can't, but you can give birth to it here. The woman has the baby and is like, I don't want my child to be risen. God, what the fuck words am I saying? She doesn't want her child to be raised by a creepy pedophile. So she's like, maybe what I'm going to do is just give her a common person name and you can raise her. And Miss Suxby is like, interesting.
Yeah, sure.
Okay.
But I just have to give them another baby.
If I pass off a baby because the uncle and the father came by to, you know, figure out where mama is, she's like, put it down in paper. I'm going to stick it in my tits and live with it for 20 years. So has paperwork saying that Sue is officially a Lily, the house of, and Sue will never know her true upbringing, but Miss Suxby will watch over her. Maude will be raised as a Lily and come to adulthood. And on the 18th birthday, Sue will actually inherit her money. Well, things kind of keep going crazy. Maude kills
This is where
Gentleman.
It started to like lose me a little bit.
Maude stabs Gentleman because everyone is pissed. Sue breaks out of the madhouse. Maud is pissed. Miss Suxby's trying to protect and suck on the hair of Maud for whatever reason, because that happened a little bit too many times. And Miss Suxby decides, I'm going to protect Maud. And as everything turns out, she gets hung for the crime of killing gentlemen. And what ends up happening is Sue and Maud go off and live in the house that
in the mansion,
this crumbling mansion in the countryside, writing porn together. And you know what? What a beautiful life.
What happened to the uncle? Did they say what happened to the uncle? Or he just, like, left?
He, like, basically became... Okay, so Maud cut up all his books when she was leaving.
That's right.
Yeah, I've left out a lot of good parts, but we've all read it at this point.
That's the gist of the story.
That's the gist of it. It was a whole switcheroo on top of a switcheroo, on top of a murder switcheroo. So it was just a lot of where's the marble under the cups kind of deal. And you know what? Great. And... the uncle became catatonic when Maud cut up the books when leaving for the wedding, and then just died. And good riddance. You creepy
good
dick.
Riddance.
Yo,
One of the main reasons, too, I think they talk about this, too, is Sue's actual mom, the heiress to the fortune, the mansion, all that stuff, left Sue there because she wanted her to grow up in among common people. She didn't want her to grow up in the higher end mansion and all of that stuff. So she really wanted to appreciate this sort of lifestyle. So when she got the money, she wouldn't be spoiled or anything like that. She would use it, you know, for good. And she ended up using it to write more porn.
I think, how else could you use something better? You get it's like, you know, if you gave me $1 million as a seed, I'd be like, I am going to write you some quality porn.
I will say, as much as, you know, you picked this book for LGBTQ Cuba, but you also forced me to read a book about books. And there's one line in this whole book that I loved where I was going to say that you have a name for your disease called hyperesthetic one. You have been encouraged to indulge yourself in literature and have inflamed your organs of fancy. You have read too much, Kelly.
Funny that you should say that because I marked it down too.
You have read too much literature,
you
crazy
were to send
lady.
Insane, you know, asylum doctors over to my house. They'd be like, this girl is a product of reading too much. That's
classic it
caused,
reading.
It caused the gay and it caused the overactive imagination in her brain. That's it. That's all.
I want to really dive into this book a lot. So I have a lot of questions.
Please. I'm so glad to finally have a Fingersmithian.
Welcome to the club. So the plot is a little confusing of what the grand scheme of it is. So Mrs. Suxby's daughter is Maud.
Correct.
And the rich lady's daughter is Sue. Okay, so we know that. She drops off Sue and is like, you need to give her a baby so Sue can stay here. She just gives up her natural born daughter instead of just a random baby, which is, I find, a little weird. Also,
not to mention when the baby comes back, aka Maud, she's like, you know what? It's good to have that. It's nice that the uncle touched you and not anybody else. It's better at home than the stranger.
Remember they were like, how much
she's
did he
like,
touch
did
you?
Did he touch you or just make you read filthy things? And she was like,
I just read
the
books.
Fifth on that. Yeah. I just read the books, ma'am. I don't know who you are.
I feel like it's a very complicated way to get a fortune.
Yeah, but Miss Suxby is, like, dyed in the wool, man. Like, she knows, like, how to finagle. And maybe she wanted the best life for her daughter, too. I mean, growing up in a madhouse for, 11 years might not have been the private school I would have signed her up for. But at the same time, I think it was, like, a means of being, like, she's not going to do much better here. Why not try this for my natural-born daughter? Gave her that chance to do it. You know what I mean? And she just gave birth, so who knows what kind of crazy female hormones are going on in her head.
And Gentleman was in on it, right? The whole time.
Gentleman, so I'm positive that Miss Suxby had enlisted him, like, maybe, like, during the time prior to that. And, like, he had to put a lot of groundwork in to actually get accepted into the Uncle Lily's house. So,
he put a lot on the line for his 3,000 pounds or whatever the hell it is. And...
listen.
Ben just ends up dead.
Violin song for Dick Rivers. which one thing I do want to say about the book, I do love, and she makes note of it pretty often, Sarah Waters, is that like the names kind of line up with what they are. Like, she, like Dick Rivers, are we really serious?
Yeah, I know.
Miss Bacon with the sausage fingers, and like it just like, it kind of keeps going on from there. Like, granted, they're British names, but it was sort of like Miss Sucks to Be Dead, you know? It's just a wild cacophony. Anyway.
Let's talk about Gentleman a little bit.
Ooh, okay.
Interesting character. Yeah. Interesting character. So obviously he's an asshole who just cares about his money, right? So he goes to marry Maud, and then they're going to send Sue to the madhouse. That's the plan. And on they get to their wedding night, and he has to prove that he had sex with her, right?
Yeah.
So he cut his hand?
Yeah.
He doesn't have sex with her?
Freaking gay, man. Like, Maud's like, get the hell away from me. Like, because the whole thing is like breaking the hymen and you have to show like blood. So it was.
No,
like,
I get that.
Yeah, but like, that's the whole thing is that like, was this an actual legal marriage? Probably not, because A, Maud Lilly is not Maud Lilly. I don't know what the records are like in Victorian era and how one computes like the system of marriage licensing, but they're not who they say they are. So he just needs the proof of. I forget her name, the one that runs the farm that they're staying on, where the chapel is. But she needed to see the evidence. Sue needed to see the evidence that there probably was sex during that time. And it was just more of a means of proof that the marriage was consummated. So he cut his hand because gay on gay crime. Like, Dick Rivers is fucking gay. And so is Maud Lilly. And they were like, don't touch me. He's like, I don't want to touch you. But we
just cut my hand.
We gotta make a lot of money, so I'm just gonna cut my wrist.
Yeah, and prove that there's blood here. Why didn't they just have Gentleman marry Sue if she's the actual heir?
I think more than anything, it's because Miss Suxby wanted Maud to come back to her, and I think Miss Suxby was also.
It's all starting to make sense now that we're talking it out.
Yeah, but so Miss Suxby at the end of the day is still kind of a thief, and you know, like grungy, and like she didn't. What's heartbreaking about the novel is when you realize that she didn't actually care about Sue to the level that Sue imagined that they had this relationship. And it's actually really hard to read that part. And I think Miss Suxby sees that when she's on, you know, like death row, as well as that, like, here's a girl who keeps coming to see me and like, who's loved me. I've loved her in my own way, even though she always just saw her as kind of like a paycheck. And the whole idea was like, if I scam her, I get the whole caboodle. I don't get half. And since I am technically the ward of her by signing the contract that she had with the mother, it was basically a legal loophole for her to get all the money and also take care of her daughter and receive her daughter back. So it was, I don't know how she quickly computed that. And like, also good for you for having a baby right away at that time with whom, I don't know. But like, it was definitely a complicated plot that just ended up making sense. And I do agree, like, a lot of the latter half of the novel does get very soapy, and it does end up being a little bit convoluted and maybe not as believable. But I feel like Sarah Waters' writing actually makes it believable because she pays a lot of attention to, A, she was an academic before she actually wrote her novels that she's now known for. So more than anything, she is very steeped in Victorian history and language, and like, granted, this is a lot of fantasy and inserting LGBTQ storylines into a time period where it didn't exist, but it makes sense, and I think we could really credit her style and her prose and the attention that she has paid to her characters and given them that space to actually have this seem more believable, because it could not in most ways. Yeah. And that's why it would also be hard to adapt it, because like, you have to have the same sort of storytelling in order to make this story come off with the shock value that it has, and also still feel original and true to the time period. So we can get into that furthermore. But like, what I really wanted to talk about too is that in the novel, like, what I really love about this book, piggybacking off of what I just said, and the amount of time that we've put into, and it's a large novel, I'm not going to lie. I think some of it could have been cut back. I won't say that all of it was necessary. I think a lot of it built the inner world of both girls. And I think that was important to what she wanted to do and also to the world building that she wanted to give to people. Because honestly, I would never really pick up a Victorian era novel. Like, everyone smelt, everyone was gross. People's teeth looked like butter, as referred to in this novel. It's not sexy. You know what I mean? It was very repressed. And I think like a lot of, particularly LGBTQ, particularly lesbian, storylines tend to take place in the past because the repression is stronger, and like the avenues you had to take to circumvent that were tougher. And I think it builds a lot more of the conflict and resolution. And it, and what we talked about even during The Notebook, sometimes you do need a period piece to make it feel interesting and new.
No, I think this was an appropriate period piece for the, I don't think it would have worked at a different period of time.
Right? Like, modernizing this would be ridiculous. We could talk about that at the end because I have theories. But like, I think one of the joys of reading this book is actually being steeped in the time period. And honestly, I think like the love that was between Sue and Maude is hard to really kind of wrap your mind around because it doesn't feel very strong sometimes in certain places. Like, there's a lot of hate. There's a lot of class aggression. There is a lot of just typical, like, these women are trying to perform roles in a society that is asking them to perform within a male gaze. And they're trying to discover who they are. And they don't know. They've been sheltered only within these two forms that they've ever seen. And those two things intersect. So I think it was a really good love story in the sense that it was so subtle because these two people didn't expect it and never knew what they had. They only understood that their passion for each other and the fact that they were intertwined in a way that they would never be able to untwine is really powerful. And then you add the historical aspect of it, it makes it make more sense. It gives you those layers of like, oh, wow. Of course she doesn't feel this way because like she has to think about, I don't know, eating tomorrow, getting out of a madhouse where like people don't have like human rights like they do today. You know, there's just so much going on that I think what Sarah Waters was able to give people for a world is something that is foreign, but it feels still relevant enough. And then to lay a lesbian template on that, it's not just a love story. It's a conflict of who did what? How is this happening? The twists seem a little bit more darker because they have a lot to lose. And it's also very interesting as women because the amount of agency that they have is borderline zero. So I don't know. I've like kind of ranted and I lost my original point, but
you start off by talking about the relationship between Maude and Sue, and part one, I love their relationship because Sue is less like this country bumpkin who doesn't give a shit, and Maude's very pristine and proper and all this stuff. So there's like a scene where Maude is like, she's trying to go to sleep or something, and Sue is like getting frustrated, and she says something like, What do you think about at night? And she goes, I just think about you fucking going to sleep. Like, in her head. It's fucking weird. What? I'll just fucking show you how it's done. And like when they first like have sex, like she's like, just show her how it's done so I can fucking get some sleep.
I like how it snowballs though. She's just like, I'm gonna kiss her. It's gonna be fine. It's just fine.
Yeah, let me just kiss her so she still sees her. It.
And then midway through she's like,
go to sleep. She'll be like, what? You don't know what this is? And the Cockney accent is so good, and it's so hard, you know? And like,
the word sliding hand could be used less. I'm sorry. That was like...
I love Sue in part one. The way she talks to her.
I love Sue. And that's why that's like so heartbreaking, because I think like it's a hard transition to go from Sue to Maude, because first off, you're left off with like, oh, fuck that bitch. Like, Maude screwed Sue? And Sue, there's an innocence and a particularness about Sue that I think is refreshing. I think there's an earnestness about her. And I really feel like it's important to start with that because, A, the whole setup and the conflict after that. But also because it's a very cozy POV to start with. There's something very relatable about it. It seems to transcend time that, like, if you dropped me into something that was, like, all etiquette of Victorian aspects, I'd be alienated. You know?
Yeah.
So Sue is a very great state. It's a great place to start.
I was going to ask, who is worse, Maude or Sue? Because Ooh. Sue goes in to fraud Maud, falls in love with her, or thinks she's starting to have feelings for her, doesn't say anything, and holds back. Then you find out Maud knows the whole time, is screwing over Sue, but she gives Sue a lot of outs. She tests her a lot
That's
of times, and it's like
what I was gonna say.
She's not revealing her secrets, so I might as well just keep going along with this plan.
Thank you for bringing me back, Jimmy. You're my rock.
You're right. You're welcome.
Because I do love Maud. I actually, and honestly, by the end of it, I love Maud not the most, but very strongly.
I'm Team Sue all the way, but I agree.
Of course. But like the transition from Sue to Maud is heartbreaking because now you think Maud is a bitch. And Maud's first paragraph is basically the brutality of the birth that she has been told that she came into this world as. Like her mother is tied down to a rack, basically, and biting on a piece of wood while she gives birth to her and blood and placenta. It's a tough place. And like Maud is also just kind of a mean person because of everything that's happened to her. But there's something innocent still about her. And I think you can understand why there's this sense of cruelty. And that the fact is that once she meets Sue, and I think it's really important for love stories that they don't start off on a bad foot because it's hard to recover from that. So I think there is some sort of like camaraderie from them at the beginning, despite the fact that both of them are looking at each other as a target. But I think Maud actually loves Sue maybe more than Sue realizes that she loves Maud. Because Sue fools herself into, like, not fools herself, but, like, starts to slowly unravel the fact that she really cares about this person because she's so genuine. I think she notices the genuine affection that Maud pays her. Maud, on the other hand, holds back what she says because, honestly, her freedom is important, and I understand it in the context of what she lives in. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And, honestly, I don't blame her for it. And I think there is too many opportunities, and it's your classic sitcom miscommunication situation where if one of them had said something, I mean, if your fingers are that deep in, you might as well just fucking tell the truth, you know? And they were just sort of like, if I just said I love you and we could have figured out an equally as complicated way to get out of our life pre-feminism bullshit and try to get out of this together. And thankfully it works out in the end. And I think like the love is never lost between them because there is a substantial amount of what they've shared and who they are together. And I think it also talks about like the fact that they are compatible human beings. But I don't know. Maud, I love me Maud, but Maud's a hard one to start with. I mean, like when you feel that first betrayal, it's pretty tough.
Yeah, and it's interesting. The toughest part for I think Sue and Maud is when Sue's being interviewed by the doctors, right? And they're asking her if Maud is actually insane. And she's teetering. That's like the one scene where she almost gives in. She almost says the truth, you know? And like she keeps contemplating, but she knows if she tells the truth, then she's going to end up like her mom. She saw her mom get hung in the courtyard for getting caught for something very similar. Not very similar, obviously, but like for thieving or something like that.
Yeah.
So she's nervous about this happening, and so she continues down the path of lying.
I'm so sorry, but I do want to hear what you have to say. But that also piggybacks off what I was saying with nature versus nurture, is that so much of this is about them playing out a role that they feel like they were given. So none of them feel like they can escape because they're in a prison. They're in a prison of very limited means of getting out, of limited means of human rights, limited means of communication. And they're also during a time period where it was like, oh, if your parents are like this, you're like this.
And if your husband says you're like this, then you're like this.
Then you're like that as well. But like living in the sense of if my mother is this person, so am I. And I think that's a really interesting observation and psychology between the both of them because they both can't escape the fact that they feel doomed. You know what I mean? One feels like she's a product of a psychopath. The other one feels like she's a product of a murderess. Consequentially, they're both reversed. So, like, it's sort of like, how would you actually live in a world where your entire means of your identity is swapped? And the fact is, like, is there such a thing as bad blood? Is there such a thing as maybe these two girls actually lived out their mother's lives? Because Sue is a murderess. or not Sue is murderous, Maud's a murderess technically, because mm-hmm. she was definitely the one that killed Gentleman. And so is technically maybe her mother. And yeah. And same thing is, you know, Sue thinks that maybe Sue went to a madhouse and so was her mother. So it's sort of like the sense of like, can you escape your fate? Is it your fate? And is your identity overlaid with your parents and your mother-to-daughter relationship, especially never having it? It's like a really shitty Disney movie where the mom's died and, like, next thing you know, you're a lesbian trying to live out a murderous story, you know?
Classic Disney movie.
Classic Disney. Back to The Little Mermaid. But what were you going to ask?
No, I was going to say, going on the point of sometimes you feel like the only way out is the worst way out. Right. So like, especially in this time frame, right, where there's not a lot of options, especially for a woman, especially for a gay woman who doesn't have a lot of options to get out of this cruel lifestyle that they're stuck in. So you have Sue, who just wants the money to get out of her lifestyle of being a thief all the time and living in this poor area of the community. And then you have Maud, who wants to get out of this crazy porn reading prison that she's in. And she's like, I know I like Sue, but is it enough to keep her and stay in this type of...
To jeopardize my life.
Right, exactly.
Yeah.
It's sad that they both are stuck in that. And then it even comes up even more in part three, I think, when Sue ends up in the madhouse because she's stuck there in the most frustrating way to where literally nobody listens to her. She has no rights. The only way out is if Gentleman signs her out, which is never going to happen. So you think how is she ever going to escape this? And part three, I think, drags on for a little bit.
Yeah.
But it's my only little quirk about this book. I did enjoy it, but I'm like, all right, let's wrap this up here.
Yeah. But enough with the villainous, I'll tell you the whole scheme.
Yeah, exactly. But the madhouse scene is very interesting because it just gets so frustrating. It's like, she literally can't read or write, and they're forcing her to read and write. And she's like, I don't know how to read and write. How can I prove to you that I can't read and write? You know what I mean?
I love that yeah. because that's also, it's a commentary of the beginning of psychology and the beginning of science, honestly, because people could just extrapolate whatever ideology they had about the human mind and what's a recovery. And the thing is there was no way to disprove that. These houses, and also these houses were paid for by rich people. So of course they're not going to let you out either. And that was stated in the third act too, when she escapes and they were just oh, we're not going to say anything because we're going to lose some money on that. And on top of it, as soon as it turns out, they find out that she is actually not Maud Lilly. They're like, she's cured. just to make more money for it. It's the idea
that was confusing too.
Yeah.
Is the so the madhouse, the doctors at the madhouse thought she was actually Maud Lilly.
Correct.
Right. But she was saying she's Sue, but really she is Maud Lilly.
She's Sue Lilly. Yeah.
Technically. So it's kind of confusing. Why did they tell the doctors that she was Gentleman's wife to take Gentleman's wife home?
Definitely complicated. I think, and that's why I do recommend reading the book, because I think at least you can go back and reread it, and it lays out the information a little bit better. I think the movies can be a lot more complicated because of that. We'll get to The Handmaiden in a second.
Yeah, I was going to say, The Handmaiden is a little confusing.
You know the shocks, but you don't understand the context of the shocks and who is who and how is it related. But basically, and also I love the crazy house because it wasn't until the 70s that our institutions were actually starting to be monitored and understood and cleaned up. There was a lot of human rights infractions. And I think this is a really interesting and terrifying place to be, is a madhouse in the late 1800s in England.
The scene where the women get drunk.
Yes, I was hoping you would say this.
And try to debate who is the fattest. And just sit on Sue to see how fast she squeals is probably one of my pastime favorite games.
It's First off, the most classic older sibling game I've ever heard in my life is like, if I sit on you, you can't say anything, and I'm going to make it as painful as possible. I love it. And first off, how was that your means of like determining who's the most mass in the group? But secondly, I loved that part because one of my favorite parts about the book is the subtlety of how lesbianism is handled in the book. And Maud and Sue never really mention what it is, who they are, because there's not a context for love. It's a context of sex. And people treat it as sex. And the thing is that both of them are performing how they see their bodies in a world where it's not up to them to determine how their body is and their autonomy. But the nurse laying on Sue, realizing that she is the heaviest, and then being like, I'm gonna push the envelope, and then starts to squirm her hips on her because they all heard that Sue's a lesbian, and Sue was like, too far!
Yeah.
The fact also, that your fat ass is on top of me is one thing, but don't you fucking dry hump me. I love that.
I also like this game of they're actually debating who's the fattest, but they want to be the fattest.
They do.
They don't want to be the lightest. Yeah, it's like a strength thing. So, like, the one woman gets on, she's just, like, thrusting as hard as she can, just to be like,
just a squeak.
Fucking squeak.
More out of Sue. I love that. I think there's some things that are handled so subtly, and maybe not so subtly, but I do appreciate that. And I think it's, yet again, a really good entry into a history that you would never want to contemplate. And then on top of it, like, what
so
queerness
scary.
Means. Yeah.
It's so what, scary.
What queerness and literally your own independence actually means in a sense of where the government stood on that at the time.
Yeah.
Because you legally had no rights. Enjoy having bacon fingers all over you, dry humping you at the middle of the night. You're crazy.
Like my biggest fear is like...
Is that?
That's my biggest fear. I've learned it from this book.
No, I
just
love,
being stuck in a place where nobody believes who you are.
Yeah,
is so
and it almost
scary.
By you saying no, it affirms their reason to believe yes, because it makes you seem more guilty. I love that. I think I really do. I can't recommend this book enough. I don't think it's not my favorite of hers. I do appreciate it, and I think it's monumental of being like both a good book for twists and whatever random ass stories and introductions into like old school literature, if you want to ever pick up Charles Dickens or I don't know, Middlemarch. But having said that, it's a very good way to subtly introduce lesbian and gay trans storylines into novels where it feels natural. And you can see how that almost compounds the issue that your protagonists are going through because on top of that is this added level of shame that they don't even know how to interpret because there aren't actually words for it at the time. You're just like, oh, I'm really fucked. I can't admit to the fact that I just finger blasted Maud the other night on her wedding eve. I also have to, you know, get the hell out of a madhouse and then go back to this lower part of London and then expose this whole cabal of thieves to do it. Thank you, Sarah Waters. You did a justice to humanity.
Like I said at the beginning of this episode, recommending an LGBTQ book for this month, I think you nailed it. You know, like, I was very engaged the entire time. In the beginning, I was like, all right, I thought that this was going to be so, honestly, I was like, this book is going to be so predictable. What's going to happen? This is what I thought was going to happen. I thought, like, they were going to do this grand scheme. They're going to fall in love with each other, then cancel the grand scheme, and live happily ever after. And try to keep, like, their thing a little secret because they're gay. And then all of a sudden, it's Sue's going to the madhouse? What? Cut to. You know, and my only little quirks with it, honestly, was towards the end, it started getting very soap opera-y. It's like, She's her mother. She's her mother. We swap babies at birth. Really, your cousins or whatever. You know what I mean? Like, I felt like, yeah, it could have gone down a path, you know?
Yeah.
And it got to the point where there were so many twists that no twists were surprising me.
I do get that.
That, and it just went on a little too long at the end. I was like, all right, can we just when she escapes from the madhouse scene was long, but good. But, like, they could have shortened that part a little bit. And then she's on her homeward bound, pretty much, journey back home. And that's a little long to get back home. So, and then they wrap it up at the end. But that part three, I thought, just went on for a little long.
I think part three was, like, a little bit ridiculous. And I get it. I think it was needed as a resolution for a lot of stuff and to clear up, like, the scheme of it. And I'm not going to say I liked it better in Handmaiden because I actually didn't. But I like that they cut a lot of that because I think there was still a way to resolve the issue of what the novel proposed and how everyone had to get out and how everyone was going to meet up again at the end and the interrelationships of it and figuring out yet again whose mom is who. I feel like that did it snowballed a little bit too much. And like, I think there was parts where she could have stopped and like paused and like didn't need to keep going further with it. So I do agree with you because it is, when I recommended this, I forgot how big of a book it is. And it's not a huge book, but it definitely has a lot of words to it. I personally enjoy her writing. I think, am I going to say, is she going to be nominated anytime soon for like the Pulitzer? Maybe not, but she's a research historian. She is really well written. I think like a lot of how she says things are both in line to the history of the place and time that she's writing from, but also meaningful. And there is times where I think she can mince some words. So I agree with that. And I think like she got a little bit carried away with the Dickensian ending of it, of being like, okay, I have two twists, might as well put a hat trick on that and then make it wild as hell. But at the end of the day, like, don't we all just want to write porn with our loved ones?
That's the perfect ending to this thing we call life. No, it's, I mean, I recommend it. I mean, I wasn't,
this would be what you shopped for. I do agree with that. And I think, I'm glad that you read it, and I'm proud of you.
Would I have read it? I liked it better than Good Omens, obviously. I'd be more intrigued than Good Omens.
Which also had its twists and turns. I think this was a cleaner...
I was
worried. It's like, is this too British yet again?
No, it actually wasn't too bad. The Cockney accent was heavy, but then once they go to Maud, then it's like fine, and then... they go back to Sue. She's like, I'm in the fucking madhouse again.
I do like that they return to Sue because I enjoyed the background of Maud. I thought that was really fun to like get like the fill in and like give you the context of why she's a piece of shit. And then realize she isn't, and that she's very much in love with Sue, regardless of where she places that in her life. But it was nice to go back to Sue too, because I was just like, oh, get him. Get him, Sue. And that whole scene where Sue goes with, like, the sharpened knife to go kill everybody. She's like, I'm going to kill Maud. I'm going to kill Mrs. Suxby. I'm going to kill everybody. Gentlemen. I'm going to do it. She gets there and she's like, she sees Maud, and Maud is like, don't do it. She's like, okay. You look so handsome today. I'm going to put this knife down. My hand's shaking.
Everybody was so handsome.
Everyone was so handsome. I don't believe everyone was really that handsome because, again, I cannot turn off some of the descriptors that they put in here. Like, teeth looking like butter.
Beautiful teeth like butter. Slap it on
Land
my toast.
Lakes. Lap it up those lakes. Yeah. I mean, is this the sexiest novel I've ever read either? No. And I like that. I like that this was an LGBTQ novel without it being... pure pornography. You know what I mean? There is one sex scene. I think it was handled well. I think it was very emotionally connected, which I think is really true to what being a lesbian is. Because at the end of the day, all we want to do is write letters to each other and sit under a giant blanket and talk about what sign our dog will be.
I'm learning a lot today. I'm learning a lot. Also, a great segue to The Handmaiden.
Oh, sure is. That's like some baby dyke stuff. and I can use that word. Yeah. So, I mean, like, there's so much stuff I would love to talk about with this book. I wonder if...
So much more.
Do we go further? The only thing I do want to say, and, like, RIP, because he is... Him and Miss Sexby, I do love it, in the book, and I was just like, where are they in The Handmaiden? Is the knife boy?
Oh, yeah. A lot of characters didn't make it.
Oh, a lot of characters. But those are two, like, unsung heroes of this. Because I really loved Mrs. Sexby. Sure, she's an asshole. And she did everything wrong and, like, put up my girl Sue for, like, the gallows. But at the same time...
She did sacrifice herself.
She's just a mom. A single mom working hard. You know what I mean? Raising 17 babies, spooning gin in their mouth, and just wants the best for her daughter. You know?
It all makes sense, too, because in the beginning of the book, Mrs. Sexby gets all pissed off that Sue's on these thieving runs.
Yeah.
And she's like, now it makes sense because that's like her future inheritance.
Yeah, she's like, don't screw with my bank account, man.
Yeah.
Like, she was like very protective of her. So I think like it's also a good book to read retrospectively. I think you need to read it the first time without knowing what happens. The second time, I think it's really good to read it just to pick up on the things you missed the first time.
Kelly, I don't think I'm going to read this a second time.
It's fine. Just watch The Handmaiden or the BBC version of Fingersmith.
I might watch the BBC. I'm curious to see how they do.
Well, I don't think I own the Fingersmith version because you do have to buy it. I'm glad to buy it. And you can come over. There's not as much sex, so I'm sure Kate will be more than happy. I know. Oh, well.
Darn.
Shucks, man. Guess it's you porn tonight. Movie time?
The Handmaiden.
Oh, boy.
Came out in 2016. Director is Park Chan-wook. It stars, I am sorry, I'm going to butcher these names, but Kim Min-hee, Ha Jung-woo, Cho Jin-woong, and Kim Tae-ri.
Jimmy, you're a natural for Korean. Let me tell you, the fact that the alliteration there, da, twinkle, little star.
I announced them.
I said words, and I hope to God they sound like what they're supposed to.
All right, ready? Rotten Tomato scores. 96 by the critics, and 91 by the audience.
Wow, this is like one of the highest rated ones I feel like we've had. People love 69ing lesbians, let me tell you.
Well, this movie has got that, but it also has a lot to it, and I'm glad we paused for a quick break before getting into it, because I need a stretch.
Fair.
For this movie. Like the book, there's a lot to unpack here. This movie has been recommended by a lot of people in the movie biz for a long time. You know, I follow a lot of other movie podcasts and stuff like that. It's always very highly recommended. Some people's favorite movies. I think, obviously, these people haven't read Fingersmith, but... I think it's a great movie. I do like when a movie adaptation of a book takes its own course.
Narrative. Yeah, totally.
And not shot for shot from the book, because I know what's going to happen if it's shot for shot from the book. And it keeps me interested, keeps me engaged. I like the way they took this. They did a really good job. We were saying this earlier. This book adaptation takes place in Korea, but Japanese controlled Korea. So there's a lot of class rivalries and culture rivalries between the Japanese and the Koreans. And they really use the story of Fingersmith to control the Japanese versus Korea culture that was going on at that time, which I found really interesting. I want to make sure I'm getting this right. So Sue's character in The Handmaiden, Suki, is Korean?
Correct.
And Maud and her uncle are technically Japanese?
Correct, but there's also... So, yeah, we don't need to get into this yet. There's some kind of lineage of Korean, I believe, in their family. And that's something that, like, they're Koreans mixed with Japanese, trying to be more Japanese. So it's very important for them to align with the Japanese colonists. And yes.
Right, exactly. So let me go over the plot of this movie because it's similar to the book, but then it takes a turn, right? So you have part one, very similar to the book, where there's Sookie and Gentleman come up with this plan to trick Maud into marrying Gentleman. And then Gentleman sends Maud to the madhouse and Sookie gets the inheritance, or Sue gets the inheritance. And then they do the twist. And then it cuts to Maud's perspective again. The little difference is it doesn't go in timeline order like it does in the book, where it starts with Sue growing up in this house with Mrs. Suxby and learning about being a fingersmith and thieving and all that stuff. It starts with them at the house and then just does flashbacks to coming up with a plan. And then when it's Maud's perspective, it just flashbacks of Gentleman and Maud kind of talking together. And I kind of like how they intertwined the storylines of like, okay, you saw part one from Sue's perspective, and now you're on part two, and they're overlaying the parts from part one, but they're introducing Maud's perspective. So like, for example, when there's the scene where Maud and Gentleman are by the lake and they're making out or whatever, and Sue goes up to them and is kind of like frustrated that they're making out, right? She's kind of jealous. When it's Maud's perspective, you can tell that Maud and Gentleman were actually fighting right before that, right?
She's a stone cold butch in that scene. She's like, get the hell away.
I don't want to even touch you. But what's interesting is Maud's character is very, she's trying to get it out of Sue, right? Like in the Handmaiden, I feel like she's trying really hard to get the truth out of Sue. And Sue's not giving her the truth. And it goes on for a long time. And they do such a good job with this movie of making Maud feel like a real prisoner. Like, they do it in the book too, don't get me wrong. Like, they do a very good job. But it's very hard to go from book to movie and get that same feel. But the aesthetic of the mansion is super creepy, super dark, super mysterious. The uncle is really creepy, extra creepy, I feel like, in the movie.
Yeah. Maybe a little over the top so hard that he bottomed. Like, yeah.
Yeah, like, he's a creepy dude. And they talk about it in the book where he has the black tongue.
I love that description. That he touches, because he is at the inkwell so often that every once in a while when turning the page, he licks his finger and the ink has stained the tip of his tongue. So he has like black. It's so good.
So like in the movie, they had so much detail from a book that took place in London and England. In Japan, or in Korea, sorry. And they incorporated small little details like that. So, like, they cut to the uncle, and they did a classic Korean-style directing where they zoom in real fast, and it's just him, like, showing his tongue, and it's, like, all black on
the... Black at the tip.
Oh, it's nasty.
And it's... What's nice about that is, like, that could be something that can't translate. You know what I mean? Like, to take a character like that and... I mean, you've also talked about switching time periods. So we're talking about the late 1800s to 1930s, Korea, Japan. Not that they're the same country. Please, Korea, know that I did not say that that was the same country. But to put that position of him being not anachronistic, you know what I mean? Like, he, it made sense in that time period. It made sense as, like, a character within that world, I think is really important.
Yeah, they did such a good job at blending the culture of the fingersmith to the culture of 1930s Korea.
Yeah, which I like. Honestly, if I had any question at all, it'd be like, how did Chan Wook Park? I think is his name. I might be butchering that.
Park Chan Wook.
Park Chan Wook.
Yeah.
Okay, so how did Park Chan-wook get his hands on Fingersmith? I would love to believe that he was like...
I know.
Who gave you this book, girl? I want to know. And you were just like, I got it. 1930s, colonized Korea. I'm seeing it now. Black tongue, squids in a basement. I got it.
Man.
I know. Who gave you this screenplay? I want to shake their moist, strange hand. I need it.
He did such a good job at taking such a good story and turning it into his own story.
It is his own story, and I do like it. I'll let you go before I interject too much. But it is his own story, and I like that. And I like the over the top violence and sexuality of it. But I got some things to say, so I'll let you continue, please.
Should we get into the sex scene?
Oh yeah.
So
I think it's hard to avoid.
So this
is my brother-in-law, by the way, so we're going to very delicately dismantle this.
So in the book, when they first hook up, it's like Sue is kind of like, oh, I'm just going to kiss her, so she shuts the hell up. So because Maud is like, I don't know what he's going to do on the wedding night, right? It's classic Maud, just fishing for it, right? Just fishing, just putting the reel out there. She's like, why don't you show me?
Real bottom behavior, if you ask me. Yeah.
Why don't you show me how?
What is it he's going to do? I don't get it.
What is he going to do? So Maud's like, oh my God, Sue's like, oh my God, I just want to fucking sleep. So let me just kiss her and move on. And then it escalates. And there's some finger things happening. There's a little bit of touching.
Smithery, if you will.
There's smithery. but that's pretty much the gist of it. It's pretty quick.
I think it's quick and painless and very inappropriate. And it's not reflective. Yeah. But yes. I do want to say one thing, though. I think I do agree with you that it's treated as like Sue's just like, I'm sleepy. Can you go to fuck asleep? There's also...
Sue kind of wants it.
Sue definitely wants it. And I think that's more about the building of their emotional relationship and that... there wasn't a means to understanding what was happening between them. So I don't want to undermine the sex scene in the book because I think it was a place, I think it makes sense.
I totally agree.
And the awakening of it is during the course of the action.
I think Sue was like looking for an excuse because she talks about a lot of times about
how handsome she is,
how attracted she is
and
to
let
her.
Me tell you, this girl's been keeping her hands in some kid mittens for way too long. So those are some tender lily white fingers.
What's the bath scene?
Oh, with the filing of the tooth.
Oh,
the
my
least
God.
Sexual thing I could ever think of in my life would be, hey, while you're bathing me, can you take
a file?
That happened in the movie. In the book, it was not a bathing scene, but I mean, good
it
for
still
you.
Happens.
Yeah, there's still somebody took like a piece from the Monopoly set, stuck it on their finger, and was like, oh, let's not call the dentist. Why don't I just file your tooth and have you heavy breathe in my face? And that's going to be the most aphrodisiac thing in my lifetime. Eat some oysters, put some hot sauce on your twats. I don't freaking care. Do not file each other's teeth with freaking...
with a Monopoly piece.
And if you're going to do it with the Scotty dog, okay? Be kinky. Don't do the frickin' whatever. Anyway,
and
that's
my... Okay, so we're going to get into the sex scene.
Okay.
Pause again. If you have not seen this movie, go see this movie. Come back to the show again. So they get into the sex scene in the movie, and I think our overall reaction was, whoa, because it starts off. And then it just keeps going and going and going. And it's probably one of the longest sex scenes I've seen in a movie in a long time. I mean, this was borderline porn.
There is no way those two girls did not have sex.
They had sex. There is a camera shot from between the legs. POV. That's all I'll say.
Vagina POV.
Yes.
As you said, Jimmy, I think that needs to be the lesbian flag. You could disregard the sunset colors. What we need is the handmaiden POV from the vagina for it
was
to
wild.
Be our flag. It's beautiful.
I'm so happy we watched this together because it was so cringy and so long and so uncomfortable, but it was fantastic.
My favorite part, so when you say it's long and uncomfortable... which let's not even break that down. The first time you see the sex scene is from Sookie's perspective, right? And she's like so in love and whatever, and just like a dip, you know? you think, okay, that was like a little bit much. And it's like, I don't know how to say this, but it's very Korean theater because it reminds me of like scenes you would have seen in Squid Games and stuff. And by the way, I'm all signed on for the Korean Renaissance that we're going through because
I love it.
I love it. I really, really love it. I love Korean culture. I think this is awesome. Anyway, the way this movie is shot is definitely a little soapy. And the way that the first sex scene is shot is sort of like, oh, that was a little uncomfortable and intimate, whatever. And it lasts for a while, but it doesn't last too, too long. But then you take it from, I forget her name, but I think it was like Lady something or other.
Yeah, I don't remember either.
In Maud's character in the second half.
We're just going to say Maud and Sue.
Yeah, we're just going to go with Maud and Sue. I'm sorry. Yeah. Maud's POV sex scene.
Watch the movie.
I had to stretch after that. I was just like, I'm cramping. Like, I need to hydrate. I don't know what is going on right now. That is,
it was that is the intimate. Most,
it is intimate. It's also, like, and I hate to say it, it's super male-gazy. It really does remind me of Blue is the Warmest Color, which we can talk about later. But it's just, you can, oh God, if you want more uncomfortable sex scenes, let me tell you. It's just lesbian sex through the view of a male director.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
Like, listen, like at the end of the day, we're going to take whatever's given to us. So we're just going to say, hey, yo. But there is, I kind of want to visit this later, but I do think this movie is very male gaze. And that's the only thing that I can really say that like makes me uncomfortable because get that cat out of the way. I don't want this guy in here saying that we're doing acrobatics like Cirque du Soleil when at the end of the day, we're just like, do you want to hold hands and talk about our feelings? You know, like this is first, second date kind of business. And after that, you get it out of your yaya and you move on. You know what I mean? You start writing each other Emily Dickens poems. Anyway, continue. Sexy.
I won't comment. As on the outsider looking in. So I'll take your word for it.
Do I hate it? No. Do I feel challenged? Yes. I'm just like, wow.
So
I'm doing it wrong.
The movie's on track with the book. But then, twist on the twist, Maud and Sue kind of get together about halfway through the movie, three quarters of the way through the movie, say, gentleman's an asshole. He's definitely tricking both of us. Leading up to this, Sue? Wait, which one is the one who tried to hang Maud?
Oh, Maud's character.
Maud's character tries to hang herself. And Sue runs and rescues her and basically says the whole truth. She tells her everything that's going on. I've been led here to trick you. We're here to take your money. It's all gentleman's idea, all of that stuff. Meanwhile, there's no Mrs. Suxby through this whole movie. This is all gentleman's idea. And he's been an asshole to Maud through the whole movie, pretty much. And to Sue. Pretty aggressively. So then they decide to get together and Sue still goes to the madhouse, but then they come up with a plan for Sue to get out of the madhouse real quick. Maud tricks gentlemen into basically getting captured by the uncle, right? Or something like that. And then Maud and Sue end up happily ever after riding off in a boat somewhere.
Riding off on something.
Bells. Yeah.
The bells. The bells of Notre Dame.
We're going to get into all that too. So I want to talk about the uncle because the uncle is a very interesting character in the movie. So in the book, he's this old creepy old man who makes Maud read his porn for his audience, right? They
his
come
friends.
Over for these, his friends that come over for like ridiculously long dinners and they, in between meals, they just listen to Maud read porn. In the
not gonna lie, I'm surprised that this isn't advertised to me on Instagram at this point, where they're like, "Come to the candlelight porn reading in New York City." Be like, "Ooh, Kate, do you want to try this tonight?"
And in the movie, he also does this too. But there's an interesting character that's introduced, the aunt, is Maud's aunt, who was originally instructed to read these porn books to these creepy old men, and then is so devastated by her prison that she's in, she ends up killing herself. She ends up hanging herself. And so Maudit witnesses all that and sees what, you know, thinks she's part of this prison too, like her aunt. And that's why she ends up trying to hang herself. So I find this movie really interesting because I got more of a prison feel from the movie. In the book, they do talk about it a lot, about how she's stuck with the uncle and she wants to get out and stuff like that.
Do you think it's like a cultural and historical thing, though? Because I think so. They heightened it because, I mean, like, also, like, I'm not trying to say this is like how things are handled in Korea, where they're like, well, if things don't work, we're going to cut up your fingers and your dick and stick it in a mason jar. But I do feel like the heightenedness came from the time period. And also, I do believe that I'm so blanking on his name. I'm like Chan Bak Wook.
Park Chan Wook.
Park Chan Wook. I apologize. Park Chan Wook was trying to find a way to make this more incendiary than it was, you know what I mean? And make it like more intense. Like if you add, and like, this is the guy that made Old Boy, which I still haven't seen. And I do apologize. Yeah. I do want to watch that, but like making it something that audiences can consume and also making it more a place for like, okay, Korean, Japanese audiences, the culture of the time. Mm-hmm. And also how do you market this to people? Because like, if it was just like a bunch of 1800s women being like, oh, I don't know. It was just, you know, I was locked in the house and I didn't have a credit card. I couldn't leave. I don't know. Like that's, it sucks. And like, sure, you're equally as trapped, but it's a lot more scary when your genitals will end up in a mason jar on a full moon. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, we know what you mean if you watch the movie.
Or practice witchcraft. Anyway,
the aunt who's introduced to this movie is very prisoned and she gets tortured a lot. She gets whipped, all this shit. And then the same thing happens to Maude. There's the bells, right? She gets whipped by the bells on the hand and everything. Mm. And the scenes where she has to read the porn. Oh my God. Those are crazy scenes.
I'll give you that. I do enjoy the rendition of what these readings looked like. I think they went a little over the top where they had the mannequin. And
the
I was
whole
like,
movie
oh,
is very over
it's
the top.
It's all over the top. It's just male gaze. But it was nice to see these from the I like the POVs they chose because vagina POV, A+. Do it. It made me want to vomit and die, but I was very, very enthralled by it. The POV of the woman reading porn to a bunch of perverts who are gentlemen in their own right is amazing because like it's just like imagine reading something like that to an audience in that time period and seeing them squirm and enjoy it. It's just like it's a cringy, great visual.
Oh, I thought they did such a good job with the movie. Going from this book to this movie, I just think, I understand the male gaze part, and I agree, but the movie's so good. It's so well shot.
I love it. I just find it confusing. I find it very,
it is
like,
a little confusing.
Yeah, and I'm not just doing this for means of, like, the podcast.
We watched this movie with Nikki, and we had to explain a lot of what was going on because we had read the book.
Exactly.
So that's what I'm saying. Read the book. Watch the movie, enjoy both of them for their own thing. But the movie is fucking great.
I think did you not enjoy the movie because you read the book? Because I feel like, yet again, it's not just because of this podcast. I do enjoy the movie. I think there's a lot of things that I don't love about it. But, like, obviously, like, give me all the sex. Give me all the drama. Give me the violence. Like, that's fun. And I like how they shot it with the color correction and all this other kind of shit. But I was confused a lot of the time. Like, I didn't know how the aunt was related to anybody.
Yeah, I don't know if that's her uncle's wife or just,
was it his wife, his sister?
Yeah.
You know, like, I feel like they didn't, and I don't know if this is a commentary of the director or, like, how things are handled. I was very lost. And
watch Old Boy.
I'm sure I'll be equally as lost.
Equally
lost.
And
I love that because, like, it almost reads like a Guy Ritchie film where it's just sort of like, fly by the seat of your pants and figure it out.
And I'm trusting you to figure it out.
Yeah,
I'm trusting the audience to figure it out.
The context doesn't matter. And I think this movie is all about the context doesn't matter. All you need to understand is these two women, this one's trying to cheat this one, and this one, surprise, cheated that one. And now they're in love, and they're going to scissor forever, and they're going to cheat the guy that tried to do it to them. Beautiful. I don't think you have to have a sense of what the story is, what's happening, who they're in, what's the internal monologues of each woman and or man in the series. And that's why, like, honestly, though I do enjoy this film and I'll throw it on for anybody during Pride Month, I do have to say, like, I really appreciate it more because I read the book and also because the book is just so good. And there's no way to beat that because you're taking something that has meaning and is trying so hard to give you a context of that meaning. I think, like, these two things are kind of contrast of it. You know, the book is trying to be like, what was a lesbian relationship in this? And there's some crazy shit that happens, but, like, that's the fun part. Versus the movie that's just like, I don't know, man. Sometimes I just like to be flipped upside down and people stick inanimate objects in me and there's an octopus in the corner. I get that too.
Yeah. I mean, if the book didn't exist and you saw this movie, would you have liked it?
I think I'd be scared. I'd be like a little bit like, what just happened to me? And I think that's why I laugh when people talk about this movie, because they didn't have the launch pad that I did, which I think would make me a little alienated. I'd be like, what the fuck just happened? Is this like a lesbian love story that I never like thought would happen?
See, so, to me, I was just going to say, to me, it's interesting because, oh God, I've lost my train of thought now.
It's okay. It'll come back. So
it'll come back.
Don't worry.
Go ahead.
I was just going to say.
Go ahead.
Nothing at all. But like, what, okay, so do you, like, what you were saying is that how would I feel about this movie if I hadn't read the book? I think I would enjoy the movie. I'd be thoroughly confused. I would never feel like I ever understood motivators, who anybody was. I would feel very uncomfortable during the sex scene because I don't think they grounded it enough in a sense of love and understanding. I think there are parts of that. And I'm not saying that's necessary, but it does make it make more sense. I think rather than, and that's why it is a male gaze, because it just feels like the sex is used as a shock factor, the same way as cutting off fingers or using mercury infused cigarettes is a shock factor. It doesn't dignify the thing that you're talking about. It just makes it a very salacious media. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. And I'm not against that. Would I have had fun with this movie if there wasn't a book about it? Fuck yeah. And I like being immersed into cultures I don't understand. I love the whole conflict between, I don't love it, it's historically sad, Japan and Korea. But it's interesting to learn about that and be immersed into a culture I don't understand. But at the end of the day, if I was to pick up an LGBTQ book, I would want to love the characters. I would want to understand the characters. I would love to see this like burgeoning of like feelings between people rather than just like, I'm gonna scissor you to next Tuesday, you know?
Well, I mean, you're going a lot to the sex scene, which is long and probably about half of the movie, but why I like the book and why I like the movie are totally different. Totally different. Totally different.
I get that. Okay, so what about the movie is your favorite?
There's a lot of it. So I love the horror aspect of it. I love the Japanese-Korean culture of it. I love how they adapted 1800s Victorian English book into his own culture. I always love a movie that I walk away from having a lot of comments on and that I'll remember forever. So like this movie, I'll remember forever. You know what I mean? I'll never forget this movie. Say what you want about it. You'll never forget the images that were burned into your brain forever. It's the same. It reminds me of like a lot of people love Mulholland Drive, right?
Yeah.
Ooh, we talk about Mulholland Drive a lot,
good
right?
Good comparison.
And the first time I watched Mulholland Drive, I was like, I don't know what the fuck I'm watching, yeah. right? But I couldn't stop thinking about it. And I researched it and I looked into it and I talked to people about it. And then I got more theories about it. It's kind of the same kind of way. And I think if you just walk away from the movie being like, it was fine, I don't think that's a good movie. But if you come away from a movie talking about it a lot, like we watched this movie together. And at the end of it, we were me, you and Nikki were talking about it for so long.
Yeah.
And I think that's what makes a very engaging movie. Nikki stayed up for the whole movie. She didn't fall asleep. That's a win. I mean, how could you?
Homophobic, if you will.
Yeah. Nikki, come on. It's Pride Month. Watch the whole movie. I want to go over a couple quick things before we wrap up the movie. We talk a lot about the uncle, but I love this character, right? Super creepy, like extra, extra creepy, extra good villain. There's the end scene where Gentleman gets caught, and he kind of is, I like Gentleman in this part of the movie where he's just accepted his fate and that he knows he's been tricked by Maud and Sue, and he's got the poison cigarette, right? And they go down to the uncle's dungeon, and you've heard about the dungeon throughout the movie, but you don't really know what goes on down there. And you go down and they just pan over this dungeon, and in mason jars behind Gentleman and the uncle are just penises and vaginas in mason jars that he has cut out of people in the past. And a Gentleman lights up his cigarette and smokes it, so the uncle dies. And it's probably got my favorite quote of the whole movie, where he says, at least I'll die with my cock intact. And then it just, they both die.
And that's why it's a male gaze movie.
Yeah. That's how we all want to die. Really. At least I'll die with my cock intact.
I made
intact.
It through this whole movie with my dick intact.
Then cut to
there was
Maud
some good lines
Sue.
In that.
Great lines in this movie. Cut to Maud and Sue riding off in the sunset on their boat, and they have the balls from the whipping that they're using for the next sex scene that you'll watch for way too long.
Pussy whipped to the next level.
It's got great twists, great quotes, great camera angles, great movie poster. One of my favorite movie posters.
I think there's like two movie posters that I actually appreciate with that. Because like I like the
yellow one.
Yes, the yellow one that looks like the old water prints that they would do from like Japanese culture. But I also liked the one with all of them like kind of like holding hands. It looked like the L Word season 3.
Yeah, I haven't seen that one. Yeah. I've only seen the yellow one.
That's relevant. The yellow one's really good.
But that's all I had on the movie. Recommend.
So here's a question for... like, how did you feel they did the treatment of Gentleman from movie to book?
I'm sorry, repeat the question.
Gentleman, movie to book, who did you think did more justice to Gentleman?
Oh, I like the movie Gentleman.
Mm.
Because just for the ending alone, because he's accepted his fate, he kills the uncle, he, you know.
Yeah, he has a little bit more, I think it's definitely more redeeming. I think he, like, despite the fact that he, I think it is explained that, and I think they call him the Count in the movie, is that poor kid from poor upbringing, he never kind of lied too much about it. He was just like, oh, that's just the title I was given. I've moved on from there. And then he ended up, like, putting in all this backward to, like, get to her. And then was just like, you know what? I've been had. I'm going to just ride out into the sunset.
I love that.
But I love the fact that Gentleman is such a dick in the book. Like, I don't think Dick Rivers, but like
he's also a dick in the movie.
Yeah, he's definitely a dick in the movie. And I think like that whole, when he tries to have sex with
He's rough with Sue and Maud. And
he's abusive. And I think like that's very evident in the book because like here's a man that honestly, like we've talked about and we've hinted at it, like we think he's both gay. Because he has no interest in women. He makes a very big priority about that. He cares only about money. That's not a gay characteristic. But like, he only cares about the Hamptons and raising his 3 Pomeranians. No, this is about the fact that he doesn't have any interest. He shows literally zero interest when he could take advantage of it. And in a position that he was in, especially during that time period, you're like, why doesn't he show any interest in either of these two women who are at his beck and call? And then he has like that really weird relationship with the knife boy, whose name I forget now.
Just leave it as knife boy.
Knife boy. And like, there's just like weird hints and allusions to it. And I do like the gay on gay crime that he's just like, are you guys lesbians?
I just picture Dick Rivers twirling his mustache.
His hairs. And just being like, oh, you ladies, you just get so wrapped up in it. And I just love that. I like the fact that like he gets used by Miss Suxby. He doesn't care. He's just like, hey, listen, I'm just trying to here to make money. And it turns out he's just like a good looking guy that came from like a middle class, like lower middle class family that just bullshitted his whole way because it confirms the character that he is. So for me, I like the movie version in the sense that it was a different version of him. I liked that. But I love the book version only because I'm just like, oh, he was working with what he had. And, like, I do like that queerness about him. I like the sense that, like, you never know what his agenda is. He's at multiple people's beck and calls. He's always somebody's helper, but is he really working for himself? It makes him more mysterious, I guess.
So in the movie, it's interesting because you talk about male gaze and stuff like that, too. But in the movie, I like the male characters more than the book. And in the book, I like the female characters more than the movie. So I like...
Do you think it's because the treatment? Like a female author will... Okay.
Probably. But the movie, I like Gentleman and the Uncle better. I thought they were written really, really well. And in the book, I like Sue and Maude better. I like their relationship. I like their chemistry. I like the way they talk to each other. I like... their internal struggle of whether or not they should go through with it, stuff like that.
Yeah, but I totally get
recommend
that.
This movie.
I would still recommend this movie. I can't recommend this movie without recommending the book first.
This is like the first one in a while where we both loved both book and movie.
I do. I will say the first time, I want to be honest, the first time I watched the movie, and I think I've already talked about this, I'm still not sure if I remember if it was related to Fingersmith or not. But I was like, once I did realize it, I was like, oh man, they changed it. And like, it always hurts me a little bit when something is changed on a fundamental level. Mm-hmm. And then I recuperate and I'm like, oh, it's its own story. I can live, you know? Like, I do like that it was different enough that it became its own thing.
See, yeah, that's what I like.
Yeah. I mean, they changed the culture. They changed the time period. They changed the ending. They changed a lot about it that all of it still worked within the boundaries and the place where it needed to be. And I think even Sarah Waters was like, a little pornographic, but like I'm into it.
See, that, I think that's like a perfect balance from book to movie, where it's enough of the book and the themes of the book, but you make it your own.
Yeah.
Because anybody could just take a book and remake it into a movie shot for shot.
People try and they fail. That's what we talk about.
I know,
because like
exactly.
There's so much stuff, like you lose the feeling and the intention of what was coming from it. This was like you could tell the intention was very different than the book.
Yeah.
Like what he was trying to do was to make like this beautiful lesbian love story and weird Dickensian kind of story plot line where they're like, nobody is what they seem. But at the same time, I still have to say that the movie is wildly confusing and sexual. It's not something that you can share with a lot of people. Like, I'm blessed that we could have watched that together.
Without my sister.
And not, oh, God, never with Kate. Like, she would have killed herself.
Yeah, I agree.
And so would I. But...
yeah, there's a lot to unpack here. I think I like when a director takes his own artistic view on a novel. That's what I'll say.
Yeah.
That's how I end my argument.
My only argument is that I think what we were kind of saying about the male characters being treated with such care in the movie came from the fact that it was a male director. You know what I mean? And I think like that gave it, I will always remember Orange is the New Black. Great first season, everything dropped after that. But like the male characters were always pieces of shit and they were very one-dimensional. And I think that's very easy to do when you're coming from a perspective of like, oh, we're a female, we're driving this, and vice versa. You know what I mean? And I think this movie gave a lot more breadth and interest in the male characters and making a world that would be interesting to male people, however you identify. The book might not be for guys. You know what I mean? I can't see too many people picking this up and being like, I'm into this, you know? Until you add dicks and mason jars, people are not going to be as enthralled.
Yeah.
I think the book did a really good job of creating a really gorgeous tapestry of a lesbian relationship, however they may or may not identify, and a history period that also draws from literature. That you could be like, oh, there's some twists and turns that are super, like, old school, and it's kind of fun to, like, enjoy this ride. I just think, like, I think it's fundamental to read this book for a lot of people. And by the way, I forgot to mention this during my book genre part of this, but it was David Bowie's top 100 books to read.
What number?
68, and I'm so mad he didn't put it at 69. Yeah.
What are you doing?
Fucked up, David Bowie.
What are you doing?
So it's just, and I mean, like, she was shortlisted for the Booker Prize. So like she has a grasp of language. She has a grasp of the history, and like, she's a lesbian. So she's writing from a position in which she's giving you the full breadth of what these relationships look like and what they may look like in a time period where it wasn't accepted. So I think it's like a breath of fresh air for people to be like, we have so much right now, regardless of whether we're still fighting, we are still fighting for it. It's nice to see those because it gives you that perspective. And that's why, like, I think the book is so important, not just because, like, the movie is great and fun, but the book gives you something to enjoy fun, but it gives you a sense of what a relationship is and the dynamics of what kind of goes into it and the complications of your own life and what you think you should be that dribbles down and makes it convolute the relationship you may or may not have with the person that you love. So for me, team book. I'm sorry. It's going to be team book. Watch The Handmaiden. Have your fun.
Read
it. Wildly masturbate.
It.
I don't care. I just think that...
Kelly, we know what you think. We know what you think. This is a book and movie podcast, okay?
Fine, fine. I really do enjoy the movie. I do. I think it's really fun. I do also recommend the adaption on BBC. So, like, if you don't have the time, fuck you. But there's other ways to indulge in the storyline that I sanction.
What book recommendations do you have?
Charles Dickens. Not that I'm a huge fan, but Great Expectations would probably be up your alley if you read this. I have mentioned it 3, 4, 5, 6 times. Tipping the Velvet is such a great book. It's her first novel. Sarah Waters was just rambunctious as shit. If you think there's her twists and turns in Fingersmith, and I think like because they're so limited, they hit harder. Tipping the Velvet is just over the top. I loved it. I really would recommend this novel to every queer person and non-queer person. I think it's still a fun read. Same historical genre and time period. So it's really, really fun. And then I would also recommend, if we're still going down the path of queer literature, I would recommend, I don't think those were words, but I would recommend Carol by Patricia Highsmith.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a few other ones. Maybe The Miseducation of Cameron Post, which I would also like to do as well, because I haven't read it, but I know the movie. So I would like to delve into that. Also, Call Me By Your Name. I know that's also a really...
Oh, yeah, that's been... So I've told a couple people that what book we were doing for LGBTQ month and stuff like that, and a lot of people recommended that book.
Honestly, I haven't read it, so that's only the reason why I haven't put it out there. I've heard excellent things about his writing. I didn't like the movie, so maybe we should really do that.
We should do
it. I think that's a good one.
So you get a win?
Yeah, there's some really fun queer things. So read Sarah Waters. I can't really recommend Affinity. It was my least favorite of the three books that I've read of hers, but that's also on the docket. So please, please read Sarah Waters. She's fun.
The movie recommendations I had were Old Boy, if you like this director. It's Old Boy is fantastic.
whose name we will never get right.
Watch Old Boy and then direct message me on social media your thoughts on the ending, because I am ready to talk to somebody about this movie. Nobody I know has watched this movie, and I want to talk about it with somebody. So please go watch Old Boy. Parasite, which is very low-income family, goes into a rich-income family to try and trick them. Another Korean movie, highly recommend. And this was one of our episodes about Gone Girl. And we didn't really talk about it, but not for the
queerness
or the queerness of it, but just the way it's written with the twist. It's the exact same way in Gone Girl. You get part one from his perspective, cut to her perspective. She's not really dead. Spoiler alert, kind of thing.
if you followed us, spoiler alert. No, it was funny because this was actually my recommendation.
For a Gone Girl.
I'm glad I forgot it because I don't like to recommend this book with people knowing the twist. Especially if you say Gone Girl, I think people will assume already.
Exactly.
And that kind of twist, like a big one. So please go into this without, like, tell people about this without ever saying anything what about it is. The two, I was going to say, like, there is one book that I would recommend, and I've already recommended it before, that talks about Japanese and Korean culture, is Pachinko. So if you like this movie, I would definitely recommend reading that, because it gives you a, because I remember when we watched this movie, Nikki was like, I have literally no idea what's going on. I don't understand the Korean-Japanese aspects of this. Korea and Japan have a lot of animosity. And I think, like, a lot of that history is well recorded in Pachinko, and it's just a beautiful novel. So please read that book. I lay myself out into the world, bells and all. Please read this book. And then movie-wise, I am a encyclopedia of lesbian movies. So if you ever want to know movies that are like this, I got you. Blue is the Warmest Color is the most sexually graphic movie that looks like this film. And there's a few other ones. So if you're a dirty bird, let me know. I will direct you elsewhere.
Yeah, that's a perfect segue. Make sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, TikTok, all the social media platforms. We're mostly on Instagram. So if you want to reach us, just hit us up on a DM on Instagram and let us know what your thoughts are on Fingersmith and Handmaiden. Because this is officially our longest episode, which I knew it was going to be, because there's a lot to unpack on both of these.
Sarah waters the garden, you know?
Make sure to sign up for our Patreon page, as we've been posting more episodes on that. Anything else, Kel, as we go out?
Happy Pride, y'all.
Happy Pride. Thank you, Geckos Media, again for putting this together. And with that, Kel?
Keep reading movies.
And keep watching books.
Bye.
Bye-bye.